there's a real distinction between women's work and men's work. So that's how I start and remember Namibia. And the African, to me, the African woman is oppressed at least three times. First, she's oppressed by the South Africans. Then she's oppressed because she's a woman. And she's oppressed because she's black. That makes it three times. Plus, she's also oppressed by the black man. And so that actually gets her being oppressed four times. When they go out, if they want to get a job, women are going to get the lowest paying job of anybody. And it's going to be the lowest pay. There are some women, probably, who, there are a few women who could have the job of secretary or a clerk in the store, but in most cases, those women will be colored. And even there, they could never hold a job that would put them over a white woman, or a white person, I should say. Man or woman. Most women are going to have, black women that is, are going to do domestic work. And that pay is really, really bad. And few of them have the opportunity to stay in school, to be educated. And if they are, they can be either a teacher or a nurse, and that's about it. And for that, they don't really need that much education. I think you can be a teacher after 10th grade, maybe even less, maybe even 8th grade.
Teacher's helper, anyway.
Teacher. And you can be a nurse, I think, for after 10th grade with, I don't know, maybe several months of some kind of training.
Excuse maybe. Me, do you make a distinction between black and colored?
That's a distinction that the South Africans make. It's in the social system of South Africa, the white, the colored, and the black. And the colored people are those who are both African and European descent.
Mm-hmm. And so they have a little higher status than the black.
Even the apartheid laws make that distinction, you see.
Still, I think, very degrading to classify people at any rate. And that's what they do. Okay, so if they get to be a nurse or a teacher, they're still going to get low pay because their education is low, and so they don't get very much pay. But some of that change I saw changing a little bit by the time we left, that the women could go on maybe through a correspondence course, or even if they would choose to go to school at the academia, I think it's called. Isn't that right?
Academia.
They could go to school there, and they could get their teaching certificate, and then they would get better pay.
Also, women can study at the Polinum Seminary.
Yeah, they can study to be clergy. In the South, they can be ordained. In the North, they can't be ordained. But they can still get their degree in theology. In fact, they don't know, I think sometimes in the North, they don't know what to do with their women. So maybe they send them here to the U.S. to get their master's degree, and then I don't know. But maybe that will change too, so that they will ordain women in the North. But as of right now, they do not do that. And the pay for a domestic is like $1.40 a day. Now this might just be a half a day, but if she works all month, and say even if it's just a half a day she works, but I think it's usually from about 7 to 3 or 4 o'clock, she'll get between $20 and $25 a month, and she's going to be working 7 days a week. Plus, she's got to go home, come home and take care of her family at home and do all the chores that are related to taking care of her kids and keeping the house and doing the laundry and everything else. Because her husband probably, in most cases, is not going to help her with that, because just the African tradition is that men just don't do those kind of work. And also, and the other thing that I think plays in for women is the fact that, and John talked about this today in his talk about, he was talking this happening in South America, but it also happens in Namibia, where the people, I think originally maybe have the land taken away from them, then they're put on a reserve, and there they can have a little garden where they can grow and keep enough food maybe to subsist. and but not enough so that they could live on that. And so this forces the man to have to leave and go work for a farmer or work in the mines. And then the woman is left behind to take care, again, of the house, to do the gardening, to keep up the farm, to keep up if they do have cattle, to take care of the cattle. She might even have a job as a teacher or a nurse, but she's still going to have to do all this other work. She's still going to have to take care of the farm. She's still going to have to gather the wood and gather the water and take care of her kids and wash her clothes. And I just don't know how they do it. But so it's really, really very, very difficult. And maybe an average laborer will maybe make like 500 rands per year. Well, that's a lot less than $500. Like in our village, there was a severe drought. It was for 7 years, 8 years it didn't rain. You can imagine what it's like if it doesn't rain for 8 years. So nothing is growing. And so the women try, like in our village, the women tried to have a garden at the seminary. There was a plot of land where they could get water from the seminary, because we did have our water piped in, where in the village they didn't have their water piped. They would just have a barrel or two delivered once a week. And so that's not enough to grow a garden. So they couldn't even have a garden to subsist on. And there weren't that many men. That was the reservation. Ochimbingwe is a reserve, and so the unemployed people live there too, because they don't want them in the city. A woman can't go if a man has his job in the city or in a mine. His wife and children can't go with him. She has to stay behind and take care of the garden. I will say this for our students, at least when they came. Most of the students from the South did bring their wives and families with them, but there was no work for women in Ochimbingwe. Like if they were a teacher or a nurse, there was nothing for them to do. Some of the women from the South, though, did teach in the school in our village because it was in their language. But the women from the North do not speak Oshiherero or Nama, and that was the language of the school. So they couldn't teach there. So they stayed behind, usually. But I will say that when the students went home, they did help their wives take in the harvest or to plant the harvest, because the school year was so that they could do those two things. So they at least were, you know, the men did at least do that. But, as I say, the women tried to grow some vegetables at the seminary, but the women did all that work. And then also they had, after 8 years, it did finally rain, and it rained very hard. And so then after the water cleared out of the riverbed, they planted wheat in the riverbed. And the men did help turn the soil over so they could plant the wheat. But once the wheat was ready to harvest, the women were out there gathering the wheat and tying it in bundles and carrying it to the waiting donkey cart, which the men drove up to the village, where more women were sitting to thresh the wheat and then to pound it into flour.
Let me just interject something there. There was a commissioner in the village, Boer, that is an Afrikaner white. He had access to machinery by which they could have turned over the soil, but he wouldn't let them use it. I just wanted to mention that. They had to do it by hand. I don't know why he wouldn't let them use it. He was not worth much as a commissioner as far as being helpful to the villagers.
And another thing that the contract labor does to women is, and to men really as far as that goes, is that the men, when, like I said before, when they come into town to work in the city or to work in the mines, they have to live in what they call bachelor quarters or male dormitories, and it's only men allowed in there, and maybe they get to go home to their wives once or twice a year, and that's the only time they get to really visit with their family. And so as a result, a lot of the men start drinking, or they maybe start having affairs with other women, and eventually this might even land in divorce. But or they might even decide to start another family in Windhoek. So it really causes a lot of problems. And for the family, I think maybe in Africa, at least in Namibia, that family was still, I don't like to say that it's not important in our country, but I think it was still had a lot more meaning, and they had a closer family tie than maybe we do here sometimes. They really have a large extended family, and family is very important. So this is really very, I think, hard.
Very destructive of the regime to treat families in that way. Try it.
And let's see. Oh, no, another thing is, like, these men, when they're working there, they're usually not even called by their name. They're just called by a number. And this is also very, very degrading for them, for any human being. And if they're going to work, and they usually get rides in a truck, an open truck in the back. And if there is room in the front, they're not going to let that person, the black man, sit in the front. He has to ride in the back of the truck. And again, just always, always putting them down. For women, maybe sometimes women even feel this more than men, because they're working in a domestic situation and they have more contact with, a lot more personal contact with, at least with the women who are in the house, or maybe with all of them. And another thing that is very degrading is that they call, a lot of black people, they call them coffers, which is the same as we would say nigger here. And that's very degrading. And they call men boy, and they call women girl, no matter how old they are. I remember when we first came to Namibia, and we did some shopping and bought furniture and stuff, and one of the students was nice enough to come with us to drive the truck and put the stuff in so we could get it back. And he went into the store with Dave to pick up some of the furniture, and the lady in the store, she looked at him, she's, oh, I see you have your boy with you. And they just assume that, you know, that's who that is. And the other thing,
the rest of it is, I said, it's not my boy, it's my friend. And after a while, someone else told me, she probably figured you two were gay. That's how bad it is. Okay.
Also, especially in the North, I wanted to mention this before, that adultery, and I'm sure it is in the South too, is a very serious problem, and they take it very seriously. In fact, one of our students, a female student, told me this. She said she just, you know, thought that the adultery that was going on was really, really terrible. And she said, before the missionaries came, we didn't have all this adultery.
Hold for a minute. Can you figure out why she would say such a thing? Why she would think that the missionaries brought it on?
Well, the missionaries finally put a label on.
Well, they weren't. These are the Ovambo people, particularly we're thinking of now, and they were quite moralistic, you might say, in their sexual conduct.
That was serious business.
It was a serious thing, and even a person guilty of adultery might be burned, right?
Yeah, she said, that they, before the missionaries came, that if a woman was caught in adultery and she was obviously pregnant, say, that she would be burned. And I said, well, what about the man? Well, he would also be punished. Now, I'm not sure if he would be burned or not, but he would be punished. And I said, well, it seems to me that that crime is a lot worse than the adultery, or, you know, than having this illegitimate baby. Well, she agreed, but she just said, then when the missionaries came, then they just said, okay, here they came and said, you know, we're supposed to forgive people and not be around doing this punishing. And so, okay, then we come with all this forgiveness, and so now look what we got.
That's the point. So it's okay. We get forgiven, what the heck, you know. We sin, God forgives, it's a good system. Apparently, this is the way some would think of it. They didn't all, though, but she seemed to feel that was causing some people to think that way.
And I think for most black women, and you know, they're women just like we are, who like to have nice things and dress decent. But most of them, I think, especially the ones in the villages, and maybe the ones who do domestic work, don't really have enough money that they could buy themselves clothes or buy themselves some of the necessary toiletries that women really need. They don't even have money to buy things like that. I know in our village, especially the Damara and people, because we have more Damara and we have few Herrera, but mostly the Damaras would wear long dresses, Victorian style, that the missionaries put them in, I don't know, I suppose 100 years ago, and they're still wearing them, and I don't know how they can stand to wear them because it's so hot there. And then these tight fitting things and this big headpiece and long skirt, and the richer you are, I guess the more petticoats you wear underneath all of this. But the women in our village were very poor, and if they had two dresses, they were lucky, because I can remember sometimes going, and some of the women would, like if their dress had a tear here, they would take it from another old piece of material they had, and they would carefully rip it apart so it would fit this part, but it was already so rotten that it could hardly hold up, but that's all they had. So they really, you know, it was just to keep basics. Food on a table, and for them, in our village anyway, the food that they had for the whole family was mealy meal. This was, came in these bags. This, I think, was a 20. No, this was a 50.
Most of you folks saw this, I think.
Yeah, 50 kilo bag of cornmeal, and they would eat this three times a day for breakfast, lunch, and supper, and that was it. And if they were lucky, they would have sugar on it, or maybe milk. And so a lot of children in our village were suffering from malnutrition, because that's not quite enough to get all your nutrients out of this, the cornmeal and mealy meal. But maybe if they were really lucky, they would get to have meat maybe a couple of times a month. Let's see. I also like to tell you another story about one of our students who was from the north, and he left his wife behind with five children, and she was a teacher. Yeah, I think she's either a teacher or nurse, I forget. And she also took care of their farm and everything. And I was talking to him once, and he was telling me that he was kind of really excited because his wife was going to be having a baby, and this was going to be her sixth child. And I said, wow, that's a pretty good sized family. I said, I suppose that's probably all the kids you're going to have. And he says, oh no, we're going to have, oh, we want at least 13. And I said, well, don't you think this is kind of hard on your wife to have this many kids and take care of the farm and, you know, work and everything? And he says, oh no, she likes it. And I said, well, did you ever ask her? And he said, no, because I don't think, you know, they don't ask women those things. They don't, I don't know if women have any rights on that score or not. But I have to say about this student, at least, by the time we left, he was beginning to turn around a little bit, and he was considering that maybe his wife did have some rights, and that she, you know, that he might maybe consider, and maybe they wouldn't have 13 kids, and that women...
10.
Maybe that women... yeah, that women... Maybe, you know, women were somebody at least. I taught English as a second language at the seminary, sometimes it was really difficult to get the guys to talk English, or the students to talk English. But if I ever wanted them to talk English, and this way I also could find some things out too, was just to bring up the subject of women and women's rights. And they would really have lots of strong opinions about that. And so they'd forget that they couldn't talk English, and they'd start talking English. But really, they just figured for sure that women were definitely were lesser than men, that men were just superior, that God made men better, and that women are down here, and that women are subservient to their husbands, that whatever their husbands say, that's what they have to do. There's no choice. This is just the way it is. This is the way God made them. And we could go back and forth because I really have some strong feelings the other way. So we get some pretty good discussions going, especially if you would talk about having women ordained. Now, most of the students, even some of them from the South, weren't so sure that women should be ordained. They really had strong feelings about that, even though there were two women who, no, two, was it just two? I don't know, two or three. Yeah, two. No, and also,
Julia.
But there were three women at the seminary, but two in this one class. And they just said that it's just impossible for women to be pastor because then that would put them over men, for one thing. And how can they possibly be pastors and have babies? And who's going to take care of the children? And it just couldn't work because they wouldn't be able to carry out the duties of a woman. And that just to observe this authority over men was just more than they could handle it. They just couldn't accept that at all.
Let me mention something here. I had a discussion in one of my classes once. I was teaching New Testament. I don't recall which passage it even was, but we got into a discussion of the relationship of husband and wife. And one student asked me very seriously, he said, "Don't you think that it's ever a time when there's a reason for a man to beat his wife?" And I had just said, "There is never, 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 never," I said it about five times, "ever any excuse for a man to beat a woman, or for anybody to beat somebody." And then that's when he said it. Isn't there sometimes when maybe you have to do that? You just have to do that sometimes. And then he kind of smiled because he knew what the answer was.
But I still think that they think that that would be okay.
I think so, yeah. But he knew what the answer was supposed to be.
And
he was a nice guy. I kind of think that maybe he took it to heart.
Maybe, but I think most of them probably would have to admit that they probably did hit their wives at one point or another. I think, I just went out of my mind. I wanted to read this part from before, and I forgot, so I'm going to read it now. This is about how a woman feels who works as a domestic for a white home. And it says here, especially we workers who are working in the kitchens, we find that the whites or our employers think they are better than us, that they are cleaner than us. But they forget that it is we who are washing their dishes, cooking their food for them, making up their beds. But when the time for eating comes, they take a tin, a metal container or a can, and give us food in the tin instead of in a plate. It means that those whites regard us lower than our dogs, because when we get our food in a tin, they tell us to go and eat outside, while I have to wash the plate where the dog is going to get its food. And the dog can eat inside the room while I am ordered to go and eat outside. The employers do not regard us as human beings. Now, that's not all white people, of course. Now, I'm glad to say that, but there are some like that. On the other side of that, some of the crafts that you saw, some of the things over there, were made they were all made by black women, but there was this white German woman who hired these women to do this kind of work. And I don't know if some of you maybe saw me wear my quilted jacket, and that was made in Africa also by these women. And she had very strong feelings that these women should be paid the same as any white woman who would be doing the same kind of work. And so some of her things were maybe a little bit more expensive than in other places, but she really felt very strong that there should be equal wages there. And she lived in a very nice part of Windhoek, actually it was called Kleine Windhoek, and it was in a very nice area. And the women came there to do the work, to sew. But she said she could she couldn't have too many of them come, because then the rest of the people in that neighborhood would really start complaining about all these black women coming, these black people coming into their neighborhood. So maybe just enough that she could say, well, these people work for me, you know, they're my servants or whatever. So a lot of them would do some of their work at home, because she just couldn't do that.
She was a very good person, but she didn't quite have the nerve to stand up to those neighbors, I guess.
I think the neighbors probably would have, I think she would have been forced to close up her whole shop.
Well, maybe that was the problem.
Because I don't think she wasn't the kind that was afraid to stand up for them. Also, another story I'd like to tell about women is this one woman in our, at the seminary, was pregnant. And we did have a clinic, if you want to call it that, in our community, but it wasn't really very good. There was a nurse there who was a very nice nurse, and she really tried her best, but she, again, only had up to 10th grade education and maybe 3 months of training as a nurse, and she was supposed to run this clinic. And the doctor came twice a month, and he was supposed to come for 2 hours at from 10 to 12, but mostly he didn't get there in his airplane till 10:30. And then if he had to see 50 people, he saw 50 people. One time I didn't really ever like to go to him, but this one time I had this really bad sore throat, and I couldn't seem to get rid of it, so I thought, oh, what the heck, I'll go and see if I can do anything. But I thought, well, I'll do my class first, and then I'll go. By the time I got there, it was 10:30, and there were all these people still waiting, and I said, you know, and then they said, well, the doctor didn't arrive yet. And I said, you think I can still see the doctor? And she says, oh, sure. And I said, well, I don't think I will, because I don't want to wait till 50 people get to see a doctor. And thinking like an American, that it takes a while before you see 50 people. And she says, oh, no, it's no problem. Just fill out this form, and when he comes, you can go in and see him. And I said, I don't want to wait this long. And she said, no, it's all right. You don't have to wait. And I said, well, no, I can't do that. But anyway, then this friend of lecturer's wife was there, and she happens to be a German gal, and her little boy had been scalded all over the place, and she, a couple of days ago, and she just wanted the doctor to check to see if it was healing all right, and she needed some more ointment. So I thought, well, I'll just wait with her. So as soon as the doctor came, the nurse came up to me, and she says, you can go in now. And I said, no, I can't do that. I said, these other people are all ahead of me. And I said, no, I won't do it. So she said, so okay, then she had this next woman, the one that was first in line, go in. And I was talking to the German woman. I thought, well, we're going to have to wait a little while. And I know that woman wasn't in there a minute, and she was out. I don't know what he did, but I know a couple of them told me that the doctor would never touch them. I think he just went like this. Then I went in with the German gal, and she said, well, come in with me, because you can talk English better. So she explained the situation to the little boy, and he didn't touch this little boy either, who happens to be even white. I mean, he just looked like this, and it's fine. And I said, she said, well, I need this ointment. He said, well, I don't have any. And I said, well, would you at least look at his arm? It looks like it's infected. He says, I told you I don't have any of this medicine. You're just going to have to come to Carby, which was a neighboring town. And, you know, you're dismissed. That's it. Mm-hmm. So we left.
Great bedside manner.
Yeah.
But at least, I mean, he saw 50 people in an hour and a half. But, of course, if you don't even spend a minute. But I understand since then that the people in the community or the church there got together, and they have now another clinic, because they were just so dissatisfied with this doctor. They complained about him a couple of times, but I guess they didn't get very far with it. But the story I started to tell you about the woman in our community was having a baby. She decided she would go to the neighboring hospital, which was about... Oh, well, how far away?
Lusikas. 70 kilometers.
Okay, 70 kilometers away. Oh, so
90 kilometers.
She had to go early, maybe a week or 2 weeks early, or at least a week early to make sure, because, you never know. Babies can come early. Well, she waited there in the black hospital, And finally, the baby was born, but the baby was born in the white hospital. I guess they don't have a delivery room in the black hospital, so they move him over to the white hospital, which is about, I would say, maybe a block apart. And her baby was delivered in the white hospital, and as soon as her baby was delivered in this white hospital, she had to get up and walk over sort of a narrow pathway with rocks and stuff to the black hospital. She could not stay in this white hospital. So, I don't know. And also another thing that they do for a lot of black women is that they give them a shot to sterilize them for at least 3 months. And in many, many cases, they do not ask permission. They just do this.
You mean after childbirth?
After childbirth. They just, while they're still out of it, they just give them a shot. And this, and I'm sorry, I can't find what it is, the shot is, that they give them, but it's illegal in our country. It has bad side effects in many cases, not always. It can make the woman sterile for life. It causes high blood pressure and lots of other problems. But they do this, I think, quite regularly and without the woman's permission. So this is some of the things that women are complaining about. Also, just in general, I think the medical care for both men and women is very bad. Dr. Kameta tells a story about when he was a pastor, he took a young woman to the hospital for care, and she died in his arms because he went to the doctor's office and they wouldn't see her, and then she had to wait too long in the hospital before anybody would see her, and so she died because of lack of care. And also, this happened to one of our students' wives a couple months after we left, also died. She had a heart condition. And, you know, whenever she would tell me about the treatment she was getting, you know, she was having all these pains and all this problem, and she was swelling up and everything, and she'd go into the doctor. She had had a open heart surgery, and then she had a, I think, pacemaker put in too. Well, then they would just say, well, you know, you're going to have, this was like, say, November, and you're just going to have to wait till the end of December because that's when the doctor from Cape Town comes, and we just don't know enough about this, and, you know, she's just going to have to wait. Well, I mean, you can hardly tell if somebody who's got a bad heart, you know, you just have to wait another month so some doctor who knows what he's doing is going to see you. And then even when she would go to Cape Town, she never really got very good care. And finally, the German lecturer got enough money together to send her to Germany for decent care. And so they did give her care, and they could have corrected it, but she was so run down that she died. And just because she didn't get proper care, and this was just a young woman in her 20s, who left behind two small children, too. So, I don't know, up to now, is there any questions anybody would like to ask?
When you speak about the North and the South, are you talking about just two parts of Namibia?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Why are things different in the North and the South?
Well, maybe because they're different tribes, for one thing, and so they have different cultural backgrounds.
The northern part of Namibia is called Ovamboland and Kavangoland, and it's the area that the South Africans call the war zone. And this is where they have most of their troops, or many of their troops, concentrated there for making incursions into Angola. Mm-hmm. And it's that area, and that happens to be where the Ovambo people live, and they are a very large tribe in Namibia. And the two two black Lutheran churches in Namibia are located that way, the one in the north, and then the one in central and southern Namibia. Those are two churches that have, together have established a seminary. So that's what we mean when we speak of the north and south. To go north, you have to have a permit from the police department. You have to go past military checkpoints and stuff like that.
But I think more and more, and I'm sure you can correct me if I'm wrong, that more and more military are coming into the southern part too.
Oh, yes.
I noticed from this, the 3 years we were there, from the first year to the last year, that there were all many more soldiers in Windhoek than there ever was before. And this isn't anything to do with women necessarily, but when you went shopping in Windhoek, every store that you went into, you had to open your purse and have it searched, and the man always had to be searched to make sure. I don't know, I guess they thought we were going to hit him with a bomb or what, but anyway, they every store. And even if you just went in and you walked out and you went right back in, they searched you again. So they're really kind of paranoid. But so women.
I have a lot of questions about Namibia, but staying with the topic of women, what if any is the difference, and I'm sure there probably is, as there is most places in the world, the difference in the life of women in the country vis-a-vis the city?
Well, I think, at least for me, and what I noticed when we went to the city, because I'm more acquainted with the village, because that's where we live, but when we did go into Windhoek, I think that many of the women there were more westernized. Am I right in saying that, do you think?
I think the women in the cities, they started to become aware of that they can do something if they want to, and they become more conscious of studies, after school they go to the academy, or there's night schools, or through correspondence they start to study and get a degree in something, or, and that's why men started to treat them, start to treat women better in the cities.
Yeah, I think
the reason why the women in the countries or in the valley, in the rural areas, are still the way they are is because they don't have any choice. They have to stay in the country because they can't go with the men. There's no place for them to stay in the city, and the housing in the city is very bad. There's some places where they built houses that is just a roof and a floor and a bathroom. And then the poles, there's no walls. So they use any kind of metal or boxes to, you know, to make walls and stuff, things like that. And that's why the women stay in the countries and take care of the kids, because it's more expensive to stay out in the countries because the people who own the stores mostly is white people, and they make everything expensive, and the people who work, they don't get any money anyway.
So it's absolutely unheard of for a group of spirited women to get together and cause any kind of ripple.
No, I think that that's starting to happen, that the women are getting together. Maybe that in the churches women are gathering together and realizing that maybe they do have some power, or at least to improve themselves, so that they start thinking of themselves as human, and that, you know, that they are somebody and that God gave them a brain, and just to even improve their everyday life. I was talking to one of the women, and she told me that the women do get together and, you know, maybe talk about how they can improve taking care of their children and as far as their health and cooking, and maybe share recipes and share how to make things or do things, at least. And then maybe just even the fact that they gather together and can share some of their problems gives them a little bit of sense of power and of being somebody. I remember when I was at the seminary one time, we were sitting on the porch of the German lecturer's, her name was Griseldis, and she and I were sitting on the porch, and then two teachers from the village came on by, and they came, and we were having a conversation, and we were talking about going somewhere. I can't exactly remember, it was some kind of a meeting or something in Windhoek, and we said, oh, you know, that sounds like a good idea. Why don't, you know, I said, I'll drive, and we could all go together, and it would really be good, and we'd have a lot of fun. And they just said, oh, they would love to go, but they could never go without getting permission from their husbands first. And now these were a little bit enlightened people, even, who you know, they were teachers and their husbands were students at the seminary. You expect to be a little bit more enlightened than that, I thought. But they said, no, if they didn't, you know, and I said, well, can't you just say, hey, you know, you want to go and you'd like to go? Oh, no, the one said, no. She said her husband, you know, if she didn't do what he said, he would hit her. And there was just no choice. She would have to, so that they just couldn't go. But, you know, for them, for Griseldis and I think, you know, we just thought we couldn't believe that they would still have to ask permission and that their husband would beat them if they went against them. And for them, they couldn't grasp that we didn't even have, that we wouldn't have to ask for permission, that we would just say, hey, you know, this is what we're going to do. Is it okay? Is it going to work in with your schedule? And, you know, they couldn't comprehend that. And so that was... It was good just to have those kind of conversations for both of us to understand each other and where we were coming from. But also, I think, and another thing, especially I think maybe among the Herero women, this is more, I'm not sure, but I was reading it when I was there. I read a book in regards to the Herero women but so many of the women had both physical and mental problems just because of the way they're treated and probably the food they eat and everything else put together, and that they have nobody that they can really feel they can go to and talk about this. They can't go talk to their pastor, really, because he's a male and he's not really going to understand. I mean, she's, you know, it's just another woman. And so the Pentecostal church, which has women as their leaders, is starting to grow because this is a place where women feel they can go and there's somebody who's going to sympathize with them and that they can talk and will understand what they're talking about and will have some concept, at least, of what women are dealing with. So that's one of the things that are happening there. But also, I think that the white woman in Namibia is also... oppressed. She doesn't have the rights that we have here. They're not as far along. She still pretty much has to do what her husband says. And as far as in the work in the market, I don't think there are very many executive women in Namibia that even among the white women. I think she's pretty much where maybe women in America were 30, 40 years ago, or maybe even 50 years ago.
Lois, would you say that the church in Namibia has basically reinforced sexism then?
I would say so. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do you agree? I think so. Yeah. The male, I mean, I at least this feeling I had about the pastors, that, you know, they're really up here. And
I think that pastors who come over to the United States, they started to become aware of how men treat women, and especially the pastor that we have, Pastor Nakamela, he's of Bambu, and he grew up in a community where he, as well as the woman, was nothing, but he, right now, he's the one who made people in our congregation see that they are wrong and that they treat women wrong, so.
Yeah, I was
Pastor
going to say
Nakamela
that.
Pastor Nakamela is an outstanding pastor, by the way. I know, we know him personally, excellent pastor.
And just a really neat person. Mm-hmm. And just the way, I mean, and it's evident in his family and in his wife and everything. There was also one of the lecturers who was Herero, Kapi Miyoro, and his wife. She was an ordained pastor, so they were both ordained pastors. And he did not hesitate to do women's work, quote. I mean, like take care of the children or do the dishes or whatever had to be done. They would share that more.
They were really good at that, I think.
Yeah, he was a really good example to the students. But I think some of the students thought he was a little bit strange that he would do these things, and maybe they didn't even respect him as much. But I think for a lot of them, it made them stop and think that, hey, you know, maybe you can do this.
But he was strong enough to do that. It didn't bother him. He did what he thought was right.
Even from his family, he would get a lot of, you know, back backlash from that because it just isn't done.
Geographically, is this area you're talking about anywhere as close to Zambia?
No, it's too bad we don't have the map.
The map is around, it's pinned up in there.
After a while, I have to show you.
After a while, you can look at the map.
Zambia is still southern, isn't it? Southern?
Yes, Zambia borders, Zambia does touch the far northeast corner of Namibia, the Caprivi Strip at Victoria Falls. Zambia touches there. And Zambia borders on Zimbabwe. And Zimbabwe borders on South Africa. So yes, we're still in the southern part.
The reason I ask that question is because my family and me have been corresponding with a young African black and his wife and two children for about 18 years.
Oh, yeah.
And the impression that we get from his beautiful letters written in English is that there is not this kind of submission of women to...
In Zambia.
Yeah.
That may be different there.
I don't know enough.
We don't know enough about Zambia to be able to say.
Okay.
But in traveling, like to Botswana, we traveled there, and to Zimbabwe, where both of those countries are independent, there's definitely a different feeling there that you can just see that, you know, they have the freedom, and the white and the black intermingle, and it's just different than in Namibia. Maybe they can't buy as many material goods as you can in Namibia, but then the black people, most black people, can't afford to buy all the material goods in the stores in Windhoek anyway. It's mostly brought in for the white man. And I just want to say a little bit about myself in Namibia and what the students thought of me, because I was a woman and I'm teaching them, but I was only teaching them English as a second language. And I think, they could go with that. I think some of them had problems of the woman lecturer who was an ordained pastor for being the teacher. I just don't think that they gave the same respect to us women as they did to the men lecturers. And yet they were always very, very nice to me. And at first they never knew what to call me. I told them they could call me Lois. Well, they just couldn't handle calling me Lois. And then they thought they should call me Mrs. Preisinger, but that was kind of hard for some of them to say. And so some of them just wouldn't say anything to me. I mean, they wouldn't call me anything, And then finally they started calling me Mamie, which is their way of...
It's like mother.
Mother.
Doesn't it mean mother, Erna?
I think it's in a Bombo.
They said
Mamie.
Mamie. Mamie. Mamie or Mamie. And that was very respectful, and that was easier for them to do. And so when they started calling me that, then I felt like they accepted me. And that was good.
So you want to tell them what they called me.
Yeah, and they would call it, and for a man they call him Tate, and if for grandpa they call him Tate Kulu, and they call him Tate Kulu.
She wanted to do that. That is the highest respect.
Yes.
Was it?
Yes. They have very,
very respectful.
They have great respect for their elder, for older people.
For older people. Yes, indeed they do.
And the other thing that I find sort of confusing, I guess, is that the great respect they have for their mothers. I would think they always talk very respectful of their mothers, more so than even of their fathers. And this, in a way, is sort of strange, because of the way they think about women, and then yet to hold their mother in such high esteem. But they really did.
Good sign, anyway.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. And that, this probably goes with, for all women in Namibia. When we got there, we opened up in a bank account at Barclays Bank. I think Barclays from England, but Barclays banks are everywhere. And went there to open up the account, and we were going to have a joint account. And so, but then for me to sign this paper, even to say that I, was going to have a joint account with him, I had to get his on this slip that I wrote. I had to, was like, like a little kid who has to have permission from their parents. I had to have his signature giving me permission to sign these checks. And then, I always take care of all the money things in our house and write the checks and pay the bills and everything. And so I wrote most of the checks, and one time I went to the bank, and the teller there, because it was in this little town, he knew everybody, he didn't have a bank number or anything, just your name was all he had. And so he said, you know, I really wish you'd initial, I have some kind of initial you were supposed to put on this check that meant I had permission to sign the checks, he said, because otherwise I'm really not supposed to accept these checks. And he said, well, I've been passing them through all this time, so would you please do this? But I never did it, and he still cashed our check.
By the way, in the old colonial days, who was that Namibia ever colonized by?
Yes, by that Germany.
A German colony up to the end of the First World War. That's when they lost it.
And it still is, I think, a resort place for Germans. You can catch a plane direct from Windhoek to Frankfurt. So a lot of Germans still come in, and many of the shops are, people speak German or Afrikaans. My shirt, if you can see, it says Swakopmund, and this is a resort town, and it's very, this looks like a little town in Germany. If you went there, you really felt like you were in Germany. I remember when we first arrived in Namibia, we were met by one of the students, and that was, I'm glad that happened, at the airport, and then he drove us to the mission house, and the mission house was run by Schwester Marie, who was a German lady, and the German couple from the lecturer, they had just arrived the day before we did, so we come into this mission house, and everybody's talking German, and I said, gee, I sure were in Africa and we're not in Germany. I really felt like, because there just happened to be that, you know, these were all German people around. Everybody's talking German, and even, well, when a lot of the black people that would come in would talk German to Schwester Marie, and so it was really kind of strange to...
We got some good practice, though.
Yeah.
Our German.
Brought back all our childhood memories.
Look at what the government did. The government suppressed the blacks there.
It's a government that's it's ruled by South Africa. So it has the apartheid system.
So they're probably
strictly white.
By the whites.
Yes. And now they put in a new government.
They put in a puppet government, the South African
people. Any chance of ever getting out of poverty, though?
Not as long as apartheid is.
No.
Is there. But so people are really struggling.
I'll give you a little preview. Tomorrow in our session, which is at 4 o'clock, we're going to talk about the political situation and about the implications of this apartheid, this separateness, about the political parties and so forth and the relationship with South Africa. And it may be that some of the questions that are in the back of your mind will come up then, and we'll try to address them tomorrow. I think our time is up, just about up. We have to get ready for Vespers.
This is a book that maybe, it's in the bookstore, and it's called Wild War, and it's written by Dr. Kometa, and it's a paraphrase of Psalms and also some sermons, and it's really an excellent book.
We recommend it.